ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 69, Narada visits Krishna's palaces, texts 32 through 37. We'll chant 32 responsibly. Word meanings: Putranam, of sons, Duhitrinam, of daughters, Cha, and Kale, at the suitable time, Vidhi, according to religious principles, Upayapanam, getting them married, Dare, with wives, Varay, and with husbands, Twat, for them, Sadrishai, compatible, Kalpayantam, so arranging, Vibhutibhi, in terms of opulences. Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharar vairaista sadrishai, Kopayantam vibhutibhi, Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharar vairaista sadrishai, Kopayantam vibhutibhi, Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharervaraishtatsadrishai, Kopayantam vibhutibhi. Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharaivaraishya sadrishai, Upayantam vibhutibhi. Putranam duhitrinam cha, Yapanam Dharagarashta Sudrishai Rupayantam Vibhutibhi Putranam Vihitrinam Cha Kale Vidyupayapanam Dharagarashta Sudrishai Ladies, Putranam Vihitrinam cha, Kale Vidyupayapanam, Dharaivanesha Sarishai, Upayantam Vibhutibhi. Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharaivaraishta sadrishai, Upayantam vibhutibhi. Putranam duhitrinam cha, Kale vidyupayapanam, Dharaivaraishta sadrishai, Kalpayantam vibhutibhi. Translation, Narada saw Lord Krishna engaged in getting his sons and daughters married to suitable... Does that have a typo there? Here it's, the L is missing on suitable in this book. To suitable brides and bridegrooms at the appropriate time, and the marriage ceremonies were being performed with great pomp. Purport. This translation is based on Srila Prabhupada's Krishna. The word Kali here means that Krishna arranged for his sons and daughters to be married when each of them reached the proper age. So we can chant together through text 37. Prasthanopanayanamayanair putyanam ahotsavan vikshayogeshvareshasya yesham loka visismire. Narada observed how Sri Krishna, the master of all yoga masters, arranged to send away his daughters and sons-in-law, and also to receive them home again at the time of great holiday celebrations. All the citizens were astonished to see these celebrations. Yajantam sakalan devan kvapi kratubir urjitai kotayantam kvachit dharmam kutparama matadibihi. Somewhere he was worshipping all the demigods with elaborate sacrifices, and elsewhere he was fulfilling his religious obligations by doing public welfare work, such as the construction of wells, public parks, and monasteries. Charantam rigayam kvapi hayam ahu yasaindavam nantam tatra pashun medyam paritam yadupungavai. In another place, he was on a hunting expedition. Mounted on his Sindhi horse and accompanied by the most heroic of the Yadus, he was killing animals meant for offering and sacrifice. Purport. Srila Prabhupada comments, according to Vedic regulations, the Kshatriyas were allowed to kill prescribed animals on certain occasions, either to maintain peace in the forests or to offer the animals in the sacrificial fire. Kshatriyas are allowed to practice this killing art because they have to kill their enemies mercilessly to maintain peace in society. Avyaktalingam prakritishu antapura grihadishu kvachit charantam yogesham tattad bhava bhubhutsaya. Somewhere Krishna, the Lord of mystic power, was moving about in disguise among the homes of ministers and other citizens in order to understand what each of them was thinking. Purport. Although Lord Krishna is all-knowing, while executing his pastimes as a typical monarch, he sometimes traveled about incognito to acquire necessary information about his kingdom. Patovacha Rishikesham Narada Prahasaniva Yogamayo Dayam Viksha Manushim Yushogatim. Having thus seen this display of the Lord's yoga maya, Narada mildly laughed and then addressed Lord Rishikesh, who was adopting the behavior of a human being. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, Narada fully understood the Lord's omniscience, and thus when he saw the Lord trying to find out the mood of his ministers moving about in disguise, Narada could not help laughing. But remembering the Lord's supreme position, he somewhat constrained his laughter. Om Dhyana Timanandasya Dhyana Anjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Miritamena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Some more insight into Lord Krishna's daily, weekly, yearly activities. We begin today with Text 32, about getting his sons and daughters married. Krishna had 10 sons and 1 daughter. from each of his 16,108 wives. So 16,000 times 10, 160,000. 160,000 sons he had to get married, and 16,000 daughters he had to get married. So a lot of weddings. That's a lot of money. Ask anyone who had to pay for a wedding, right, Madam Bati? Weddings are very expensive, especially traditional Vedic Indian weddings. Of course, Krishna could afford it. It says here he did them vibhuti-bhi, kopayantam vibhuti-bhi, so arranging in terms of opulences. So according to his status, his own wealth, he was able to, of course, put on wonderful weddings. Now, a significant word here is kale, at the appropriate time. We know in traditional Vedic culture that boys and girls were married by a certain age, especially the daughter. This is such a heavy responsibility for the parents to get the daughter married. Maybe that's why Krishna had 10 sons and only one daughter. Prabhupada speaks about this in a couple of places. Kanya Daya. Daya means debt or responsibility. He contrasts it with the word Rina. Rina means also means debt. Devarshi bhutapta ninam pratinam na kinkaro nayam rini charajan. That verse in the 11th canto describes that when one is sarvatmanaya sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam paririchakartam, when one is sarvatmana, fully surrendered heart and soul to Krishna, then one is freed from so many debts, rin. This verse, actually this word comes up also in Charvak Muni, Rinam Kritva, Ritam Pibet. Even if you have to go into debt, somehow get ghee. So we have so many debts, we come into this world. We have debts to the forefathers, to the sages, and so on, ordinary living entities. These are called Rina. In that verse, it says you're free from that if you're a Krishna's servant. But Prabhupada says that daya is more heavy debt, kanya daya, getting the daughter married. You may be able to get free from these other obligations, but that one you can't get free from. Somehow or other, you have to get your daughter married. Actually, in Prabhupada's own life, he talks about how his older daughter, one of his daughters, I don't know how many daughters he had, but his daughter was getting old, and his wife was very, very upset that he hadn't arranged for her marriage yet. If I remember correctly, I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur, wasn't he married when he was 4 or 5 years old, something like that? Of course, it's not like a marriage exactly, but some kind of a contract, I guess, between the families that this boy is going to marry our daughter. So it's set up from the beginning, and probably to explain, the psychology is so nice because the girl doesn't have to be searching around, who am I going to marry? She knows from the time she knows anything practically, this is your husband. When you grow up, this boy will be your husband. So at a young age, this was taken care of. Now today, of course, the idea of arranged marriages, it just strikes people as just completely outrageous. Although I remember one devotee, he told me his mother observing the movement, she said to him one time, maybe this arranged marriage isn't such a bad idea because we're arranging our own and look at the messes we're ending up with, right? Maybe if our parents did it, things would turn out better. So there's certainly a logic to that. Now we know, of course, in Vedic culture that it was done in a very scientific way. There was compatibility between the families and the castes, and astrological charts were done and so on. Now it's just on a whim. Of course, now there's not even a marriage contract taking place most of the time. People just move in together. Actually, the statistics show that people who live together before they're married, the divorce rate is higher than people who don't live together before they're married. Of course, there probably aren't too many of those who are. When I heard this statistic, I thought, well, probably the only people who aren't living together are, you know, Christians, evangelical Christians or some, who tend to be very moral and probably attached to their vows anyway. So maybe that slants the statistics somewhat. Those are the kind of people who tend not to live together before they get married, so their marriages tend to last. In any case, in Vedic culture, of course, it was a great responsibility to get the daughter married and to ensure a good husband for the son. So Krishna, or a good husband for the daughter, and of course the sons also. So Krishna had all of these 16,108 wives with 11 children each. And it said also that each of the children had 10 children, at least each of the sons also had 10 sons. In fact, this, for some reason, this idea of 10 sons, it seems to be a very common thing. I was looking in the Veda base about 10 sons, because I couldn't remember. I thought, I seem to have remembered somewhere that Christians had one daughter, but I couldn't find it. And then eventually I found it was in one purport in the somewhere in the 10th or 11th canto. I think it's actually maybe in the 12th canto, in the very end, a summary of Krishna's pastime. So there it's said that each of the sons had 10 sons. Or that comes up earlier, actually, in the Bhagavatam. So lots of children. In fact, in the Yadu dynasty, there was only one son who survived. One person survived, Vajranava, the great-grandson of Lord Krishna. And then he had a son, and the dynasty continued, the Yadu dynasty continued. But the Yadu dynasty was very large. They had only like 30 million teachers just for the Yadu dynasty, as is mentioned someplace. Actually, in the context of that, I came across something I found interesting was, I think it was about how many bodyguards Ugrasena had, 30, I think it was 300. I was thinking it was a quadrillion, but it was actually 300 trillion. This number three, you see three a lot. I've always noticed that Prabhupada, when he just wants to throw out some number, he uses three a lot. Right? 300 years, that he would use a lot. So there's actually in Sanskrit, in the rules of interpretation or writing poetry or whatever, if you say something that's sort of general, if you haven't given a specific figure, like if you say, hundreds of thousands, then it's implied 300,000. The number three is implied there. So I'm saying, well, maybe that's how Prabhupada gets this. He likes to use three so much. It's actually part of Sanskrit poetry and Sanskrit interpretation. Let's say a little more about interpretation. We come up to another verse. So this is something about Krishna getting his wives married. So anyway, the dynasty was huge, and the patriarch of the dynasty was Lord Krishna. So the next verse is about, of course, after he got his sons and daughters married, now he has this big family. So when there are celebrations, then they would come home, just like in our culture, the kids come home for Christmas. So in the context of this verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, especially if there's some yearly observance like New Year's or something, the children come home. So Krishna's receiving them. He's receiving all of his children into his home for the holidays. So Narada is observing this. He's sending them out. They're getting married and he's sending them away. Not very far, just down the street, I guess, in Dwarka. But then they're coming home for the holidays and they're celebrating. So we see how this picture we get of Krishna is just like an ordinary family man. He's got all these kids and their grandkids. Something I came across just recently in the Gopal Champu, when the residents of Vrindavan met Krishna at Kurukshetra, the mother Yashoda was really in bliss because she got to see her grandchildren. She hadn't seen Krishna in so long, and Krishna's wives and Krishna's sons, but she got to meet her grandchildren also. So Krishna's sons she was able to meet. So Krishna had this big extended family, and when they had get-togethers, family gatherings, homecoming, so they had big celebrations, and Krishna was in an ordinary way, enjoying his family life. So Narada is, of course, seeing that. He's sending the children, he's getting them married and sending them away, and then he goes to another house, and another palace, and they're coming home for the holidays, like a different group of children. So the next verse is about worshiping the demigods, which I'm scratching my head. What do I say about this? Krishna's worshiping demigods. So it's the culture, of course. We know even Rukmini, the family deity, apparently was Durga Devi. So this was part of Vedic culture. The demigods were worshipped. Now even in our own sampradaya, we're not supposed to disrespect the demigods. In fact, it's an offense to disrespect the demigods. Sometimes we can carry it too far. We know we're not supposed to worship the demigods for anything. I just got an email letter, actually. Someone's asking, is it okay for a devotee to worship demigods for material things, material boons? So, of course, I had an easy answer for that one. But we don't worship the demigods. Narottam Das Thakur says it just disturbs the mind. So we reject that. But it doesn't mean we reject that we have anything against the demigods. They're highly posted. They have their position because they're very pious entities. And they were given that position, responsible position, by Krishna's arrangement. So Krishna was worshipping demigods, and especially at certain times, different demigods are worshipped. This is still there on the Vedic calendar. And of course, in India still, if you happen to go through Bengal at certain times of the year, you can't drive to Mayapur without paying tax in every village because it's Saraswati Puja. Or I think that's the one they have. So different places, they go. Of course, it's just a way to extort money out of people driving. But supposedly, it's in the name, you know, supposedly they're collecting for this festival, for the deity in the town. So especially at certain times of the year, these festivals go on. So Krishna was observing them as was part of the culture, worshipping the demigods, who of course are his own servants. And he was also doing public welfare work. We heard already how Dwarka was, you know, had water, ponds here and there with lotuses and so on, and shade trees. So this is part of welfare work, to do nice things for the citizens. As it said, construction of wells, public parks, excuse me, and monasteries. The word for monastery is mutt. I didn't actually know this was a Sanskrit word. I thought maybe it was Bengali or something, or Hindi, but it's a Sanskrit word, mutt. So, like Gaudiya Mutt. So these are monasteries, places for these sages to reside. So Krishna was building these also. So now the next verse talks about Krishna going on a hunting expedition. What surprised me here was, usually Prabhupada, when he would talk about Vedic sacrifice and the killing of animals, his general explanation was that it was for testing the mantra, that an old animal was put into the fire, the phrasing that Prabhupada would often use, and then by the power of the mantras, the sages, pure brahmanas chanting, then the animal would come out with a new body. Of course, we don't know exactly how this works, but this is the way it's explained. So I always had this idea that, you know, they were burned alive, actually, is what I thought. But we know there's some, in the sacrifice of Daksha, when Shiva's hordes come, and after Sati immolates herself, burns herself up, and then there's this attack on the sacrifice, and all these things are happening. People are getting their faces smashed and so on. So Daksha, his head was cut off with, apparently it's like a guillotine, some kind of device for cutting off the animal's head when it's sacrificed. So apparently it wasn't thrown into the sacrifice, fire sacrifice, alive, but it was killed first. Head was cut off. Oh boy, it's... Well, a lot of times when I hear these things, just like the marriages I was saying, how it's hard for us to relate to in the modern age. So there's so many things I read in the Bhagavatam. I listen to translations a lot. I record them and I listen to a lot. And a lot of times I just scratch my head and say, what? But just, you know, the sacrifice, it's so pious. Brahmins are there and everything's so auspicious. And then you have this device that cuts off this animal's head. Whoa, how grotesque it seems. But somehow that went on. So even here, Krishna, now what surprised me here was that Krishna is killing the animals, and then later they're being sacrificed. So that was something I hadn't really thought about before. He's out in the forest, he's killing the animals, he brings them back on the hood of his chariot. I'm thinking of deer hunters, you know how they at least where I'm from, in the backwoods of Vermont. So Krishna's bringing back the slaughtered animals that he's killed, and then they're being sacrificed. So that was a bit of a surprise for me to read this. So anyway, so this is what goes on. Somehow this is allowed, Prabhupada says, to keep peace in the forest. We know even, I don't know if it still goes on, but maybe it does, that tigers are sometimes a problem, or other wild animals for people who live in the forest. So to control them, kshatriyas are allowed to come and kill them and get rid of that menace. Especially sages, hermits, they live in the forest. They move into the forest. They have ashrams there. So they're trying to execute their spiritual duties. And so sometimes wild animals have to be controlled. Animal control. Krishna has his animal control department. It's himself. These days it's just cats and dogs that are bothering people. And skunks, which I'm smelling right now, actually. I see a skunk practically every day. They're all over the place. We need some kshatriya. Any kshatriya want to... The problem is you have to dispose of them when you're done. And one day we had some kind of a big animal trap out here. And I said to Kalyapani, if you get a skunk in there, who's going to take care of it? He said, I'm not going to. So, like, the next day it was gone. So someone figured, yeah, that's going to be a problem. So anyway, Krishna is controlling the animal population and killing animals for sacrifice. So then, the wind blew my page here. So then, on this hunting expedition, Krishna is on a Sindhi horse. Now, this interested me because when I was editing the Bhagavat Sandarbha, there's a mention of this word Saindavam, which is here, it's called Saindavam, of the Sindh country. A horse, Hayam, a horse of the Sindh country. So Saindavam, this is another thing having to do with Sanskrit interpretation. There's a rule called, it's Saindavam Ayana, I think is the word. Ayana, I think is the word. Bring. Is that Sanskrit for bring, Manamati? Ayana? Yes. So the word is bring the Saindava. So Saindava can mean two different things. It's a Sanskrit, it's kind of it encapsulates a rule of Sanskrit interpretation. So the idea is that you can interpret according to the context, which Mayavadis tend to want to do away with this rule. Because they want to twist things that don't have anything to do with the context of the word that's being interpreted. But one of the rules of Sanskrit interpretation is this Saindavam Ayana, bring the Saindava. So the idea is, say a wealthy man, he tells his servant, bring the Saindava. So Saindava means of the Sindh country. The Sindh country Sindh is now in Pakistan, so formerly Western India, far Western India, on the other side of Gujarat. The Soviet and Sindh provinces, we often hear these mentioned in the Bhagavatam. In fact, that's where Rahugana was from. King Rahugana was from there. So the idea of this saying, bring the Saindava, is according to the context, the servant knows what to do. Because Saindava, there are two main products from the Sindh province, salt and a horse. So obviously, if he's sitting at the dinner table and he says, bring the Saindava, he's not going to bring him his horse. He's going to bring the salt. But if he's out and, you know, getting ready to go on an expedition, he says, bring the Saindava. He's not going to bring him salt. He's going to bring the horse. So the idea is, according to the context, the person knows what Saindava means. So similarly, in Sanskrit interpretation, this rule is applied. So it just triggered this thought in me when I read this word Saindava. Also, the Sindh province, by the way, happens to be where Pariksha Maharaj came across Kali. Kali Yuga personified, the end of the first canto. That's where Pariksha Maharaj came across him. And this King Rahugana, this passing with Bharat Maharaj, where he kidnaps basically Jadat Maharaj to carry his palanquin. It says there that he's from the Soviet and Sindh province, and then he was on his way to Kapilashram. And I thought, wow. Kapilashram. The Kapilashram I know is at Ganga Sagara, all the way in Calcutta. It's out of Calcutta. It's a long ways from Pakistan to there. And a palanquin, it's a pretty rough ride. And what to speak of the poor guys carrying the thing. And I thought, well, if they have Saindava horses there, why didn't he ride a horse instead of taking a palanquin? In any case, so that's a little something about the Sindh province. So then the final thing here is about Krishna moving about in disguise. The Acharyas say, he changed his clothes. And that's another one I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. All Krishna has to do is change his clothes and people don't recognize him. So obviously Yoga Maya is at work here. In fact, Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says, actually I was reading a couple other commentaries, Sridhar Swami and Jiva Goswami, among the three, one or two of them mentioned that this is an exhibition of Yoga Maya because obviously Krishna knows everything already, but he's sneaking around in the neighborhood of the ministers, seeing if he can overhear things and hear what they're up to. So this is part of one of the things that the king does. We hear in different places of the Bhagavatam how kings have certain, of course they have great responsibilities, but they also, they're allowed to do certain things. They have their spies going out among the people. One thing I always felt was interesting in the Prithu Maharaj story, I think it's where the professional reciters, this phrase always makes me laugh too, because Prabhupada was always down on professional reciters, right? Professional reciters of the Bhagavatam. Such disdain. But the Sutta and the Vandi and the Magadhas, those are professional reciters too, but obviously bona fide professional reciters. They're brahmanas, they're guided by Brahmin sages and so on. So in any case, when they're glorifying Prithu Maharaj, one of the things they say is that the people will never know about his treasury. So the people aren't supposed to know how much money the king has. And I was thinking today, in fact, I did it last night. You go online and you can type in, you know, the national debt. It's $18 trillion. So we know exactly how much money the government has, how much they're wasting and so on. There's no secret about it. $18 trillion. In fact, they have this debt clock and you can watch the numbers go. And it's like every 10 seconds, another $100,000 in debt. It's just incredible. So that's not a good sign to have that much debt. So Krishna, of course, he didn't have any debt, but still his finances, his books, were not a matter of public record. The king doesn't have to show how much wealth he has. So Krishna was acting in this way, like a normal king, and doing many of the normal things that a king does, and also what an ordinary grihastha does in the course of his everyday life. So I'll stop here. Any questions or comments? Jatari Prabhu, right here.
I was pretty surprised when I talked about Krishna's daughters. I never heard that one before, you know. So were any of them famous? And like, you know, Samba and some.
Yeah, I don't. The only reference I know is one-line purport written by Prabhupada's disciples. I assume they get it from Vishwanath or one of the Acharyas. Actually, now I think of it, I think it's in the summary description of Lord Krishna's pastimes in the 90th chapter of the 10th canto, I think is where it appears. But other than that, I don't know anything about them.
One other question was, you know, like if someone is reading about Krishna killing animals and stuff like that, you know, that can be a little difficult too.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of things Krishna does that are a little difficult. It's like even Prabhupada himself, when he saw that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, kill a snake. So he was surprised. Then he read, oh, Prahlad Maharaj says, even the sadhus, modeta sadhu rapi vrishchika sarpa hatya, even a sadhu is happy when a scorpion or snake is killed. So there are lots of things that are disturbing. Actually, there's a verse in the third canto, I think it is, that says that Krishna is, or Lord Vishnu at least, is the friend of the snakes because he's the friend of Ananta, Ananta Shesha. So there it says he's the friend of the snake. So. To the crown for them.
We know Lord Ramachandra used to do the same practice of sending out spies to hear how people feel about him. I mean, it's one of the practice, especially of a good king too. So when he heard that, how can his wife be with another person, and he takes him back? I'm not like that. You remember the story? And then he sent away Sita. So it seems like that was a practice of the kings to hear what the people have to say, and then they probably adjust their situations.
Yeah, that's an example.
Another thing, isn't one of the yoga dharma is animal sacrifices? Is it? The yoga dharma, one of the yoga dharma.
Well, sacrifice. I think it was a standard thing to have an animal as part of sacrifice. Well, in that verse, I'm forgetting, a horse sacrifice and a cow sacrifice are forbidden in Kali Yuga. Sannyasam palapaitrikam. Yeah. So apparently, yes. I think isn't Gomeda, isn't that also? I think Gomeda, and so even cows were sacrificed apparently. But generally in that context, as we probably would say, they weren't actually killed. They were given a new body. I think I'm ready for that one myself, actually. I'm ready to trade this one in for a new model. Yes, Guru. Have Brian, Guru.
So in Dwarka, everybody has a spiritual body, isn't it? So if Krishna is killing the animals, is he really killing them? Or something transcendental must be going on whenever Krishna is doing anything. I mean, even when he kills the demons.
Well, I don't know if everyone is spiritual in Dwarka, and well, of course, in Dwarka Dham, but the demigods, Krishna brought down demigods to take part in his pastimes, and then they went back to their posts. So does that mean they have Satchidananda bodies when they're in Dwarka during Krishna's Leela? It doesn't seem that way to me, but I don't know. This is the kind of thing where we just have to guess, I guess. A lot of these things aren't spelled out specifically, so it's hard to surmise what the correct answer is. Actually, I mentioned one time, Krishna gave 13,000 cows from each of his palaces. And I calculated, I did an estimate of the size of a cow, and I figured it was about as much to fill up Alachua County every day in cows that Krishna gave away from his 16,000 palaces times 13,000 cows. And then his sons, just like Sama got married to Lakshmana, he brought a whole bunch more. Because part of his dowry was more cows and horses and so on. Yes, Raghavendra Mataji.
Can I ask a question, quick one?
Oh, Sita D.
This is just a small, a textual one. There was that description how Krishna changes his clothes. And then, you know, I just popped in my mind as to, you know, that's some term screwed into English. Oh, he must have put on a new shirt and just, you know, that was enough. But, you know, the thought came to my mind, like perhaps whatever that term involved more than, you know, changing the shirt, you know, could be mean to disguise.
Yeah, well, of course, Krishna can change. He can change his form even, but the Acharyas use that. They say he put on different clothes.
Yeah, well.
Apparently he dressed in a certain way, maybe dressed like an ordinary person, you know, an ordinary. People are defined by the way they dress, the royalty. Even in like in European history, there were times when certain colors were forbidden for the commoners. The commoners couldn't wear purple or red or something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it could involve more than just changing his shirt.
Change his coat and tie.
I'm not interested in worshiping a demigod, but you mentioned that when one does worship demigods, the mind becomes disturbed. What's the reference for that? And can you expand on that?
Pushkar probably knows the Bengali, but I think it's in a song by Narottam Das Thakur, where he says that, you know, we shouldn't. I don't know exactly that. I was paraphrasing it the best I remember. That's essentially the point of it. That it's just basically it's an anartha, it's a disturbance, it's unnecessary. Devotees don't, they only need to worship Krishna, they shouldn't bother with worshiping the demigods. And we know, of course, one reason we discourage it because just like this letter I got, people worship demigods for material desires. One can only have bhakti with Krishna because Krishna's Bhagavan. So people worship demigods not for bhakti, we only want bhakti. Now, if you can worship the demigods for bhakti, which, of course, as the gopis did, which is another thing I told this man. I said, you know, if you have an attachment, just like we know people in Hindus, they sometimes, you know, it's part of their family tradition. They had their altar at home and they don't want to just, you know, throw their demigod statues in the garbage or something. So I said, if you have an attachment, you feel like you have some relationship, then ask that demigod to help you in your spiritual life and make spiritual advancement. So in that sense, you can maintain a relationship with the demigod and worship them respectfully, but not exactly worship, but ask for their help. Any help we can get is appreciated, so we can ask for help from the demigods also in making spiritual advancement. Madam Achi?
We see that Krishna, you know, there were different culture, you know, it was a different culture, like worshiping the demigod or other things. And certainly our culture is different. That culture was different. I guess the question comes up is that to what extent does that really apply, or should we even try It seems like we sometimes try to pick and choose, which is natural, that we should follow this. For example, particular thing that I was thinking in my mind was marrying off your daughters, you know, and that is something really important to do. To what extent, as devotees, practicing devotees, should we take those things seriously? Or, I mean, I understand for society reasons, to keep the society going good, but maybe if you could comment on that.
Yeah, this is one of those issues in ISKCON where devotees are going to be, there's a wide spectrum of their opinions on these things. You know, there are those who would like to get rid of all the Hindu trappings of the Krishna consciousness movement and just take the essence. And where are those who, there are those, on the other hand, who, in fact, there's already been some allowance made in India for, I think, and how women are, what women are allowed to do, for example, because of culture on the Indian temples. So obviously in India, you can maybe get more of the Hindu trappings, and then when we're trying to preach in the West, many devotees feel that this is, it's a problem, actually. You walk into a, you know, a Westerner walks into a temple, especially when it's full of the Hindus, and then all the liturgy or all the trappings seem so Indian and Hindu, and Prabhupada so many times said, we're not Hindus. What is the essence of Krishna consciousness? So, our guiding principles are what Srila Prabhupada taught us and what he showed. And there's also allowance for time, place, and circumstance. I often think, what's the movement going to look like 100 years from now? I mentioned that to one devotee. He said, what's it going to look like tomorrow? So things are going to change, obviously. Like it or not, things are going to change. So I think we just try to follow Srila Prabhupada's mood. And among ourselves also, we have our management structure. We have to be careful of implementing certain things. I know things are already happening in our movement that are disturbing to some people, kind of what they consider Hindu things, because, of course, we're getting so many people of Indian background joining our movement. They bring certain conceptions, and they're paying the bills, so it becomes they want something. Sometimes it's difficult in how to deal with these things. So it's a practical matter besides being a philosophical matter. So it's a very, very complex issue, actually. How these things are going to play out, I think it's hard to see, and I don't know if there's one answer to it. As I said, devotees are going to have different opinions on it. But we do look to Srila Prabhupada, try to, and Prabhupada himself, of course, he was, you know, he was so revolutionary. Prabhupada was very practical, pragmatic. Prabhupada wanted to see what worked to spread Krishna consciousness, and of course, he inherited this from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta. Saraswati Thakur, they did amazing things, dressing in Western clothes. You see the picture of Prabhupada flying, going to India for the first time with Kirtanananda. So Kirtanananda is dressed in Western clothes. He's not wearing a dhoti, he's flying with Prabhupada to India, and he's wearing Western clothes. So, you know, Prabhupada was, he adapted. He Of course, at first he resisted the idea that devotees weren't wearing dhotis to distribute books. Then when he heard, well, they can distribute more books that way, he said, okay. So, you know, there's kind of pressure to go both ways. There's pressure to not have so much looking so much like Indian culture. And then there are others who feel like, no, this is part of our identity, you can say. Devotees, you know, there are many devotees who feel that way. Unless we look like this and have this, because I often think, I know myself that like chanting the prayers that I've done so many years in Sanskrit and Bengali, and I really try to understand what I'm saying. I try to learn the meaning of the words, but still, because I think in English, I don't think in Sanskrit or Bengali, it's very hard to really concentrate and chant the songs with devotion because I'm chanting in a foreign language. So I sometimes think, just like the Catholic Church did, they got rid of the Latin Mass and they made it in the language of the vernacular. And I remember my mother, who was a very conservative Catholic lady, she liked it. That surprised me. She liked it that they got rid of the Latin When I was young, I was an altar boy, and I learned the Latin, but of course, I didn't know what I was saying. So I was thinking there probably will be, and it may not be long in the future, where there's going to be a push for English. Why do we have to chant Sri Guru Charana Padma in Bengali? That's not what's spiritual about that. Why don't we chant it in English? In Bengal, they can chant it in Bengali. So I can see that kind of pressure happening in our movement. And of course, there's a certain logic to it. Because why? We do this, the translation, because, well, it's easier for us to meditate. Of course, I space out with the translation too. That's another story. But at least we have a little bit more of a chance to meditate on what we're saying when it's in our own language. So anyway, we have all of these different forces acting and influencing us in the way we think, and they influence devotees differently. And, you know, it's a very complex subject, so we'll see. I'll see when I come back in my next life, if I'm born in ISKCON, how things have progressed. Actually, I was talking about this with one devotee, and he said, boy, he said, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm glad I'm not going to be here to see it. And so, yeah, it is. I mean, there is some reason to be concerned. You know, how much will things change the farther we get away from Prabhupada? When I was thinking the other day that what happened to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, if it hadn't been for Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what would have happened to Gaudiya Vaishnavism? Imagine who were the original Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, all these Nitya Siddhas, then their followers, the Narottam and his disciples, and Srinivas and so on, Jamananda, their disciples, and then down to Vishwanath. But then what happened? By the time of Bhaktivinoda, basically there was 13 Upasampradayas. That's what was there. That's what had happened to Lord Chaitanya's movement. What was prominent was 13 Upasampradayas. And only because Bhaktivinoda Thakur, amazingly, you can say, just on his own, out of his own inspiration, of course, he's also eternal associate of Krishna. So he was sent to revive things. So, of course, as the history unfolds also, there may be ups and downs. The great Krishna may have to send other empowered agents to bring things back in line. Who knows what will happen. Of course, now, one thing we have going for us is the books. Prabhupada said the books are out there, so they will stay. The information is there. In Bhaktivinoda's time, it wasn't there. He couldn't even find a Chaitanya Charitamrita. How amazing is that? Just a few hundred years after Lord Chaitanya, couldn't find a Chaitanya Charitamrita anywhere. But at least Prabhupada's books are everywhere. So that means Krishna is there all over. Lord Chaitanya is there all over doing their work. So that's something that, you know, we can have hope, because that groundwork has been built, that foundation has been built by Prabhupada's mercy. That's why he was so insistent to establish that foundation. So that should certainly help us to keep things so they don't get too crazy in the future, keep things in line with Lord Chaitanya's ideals of Krishna consciousness. All right, let's stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.